This is not the sermon I had intended to preach today, and I apologize for any less than fully formed ideas that were scratched out during the day yesterday and in the early hours of this morning. The world is sometimes a strange place, right? And the sermon that you so diligently prepared on Wednesday doesn't always make sense on Saturday or Sunday morning. We've had a strange news week. We weren't able to gather together last Sunday because of the snow, and then school was canceled to begin the week. Then later, as the week went on, the Speaker of the House uninvited the President to deliver the State of the Union address, and then the President canceled the Speaker's trip overseas to visit some troops. And then there was a news report that was questioned and then reissued and then questioned again that the President had directed his personal attorney, Mr. Cohen, to lie to Congress on the President's behalf. And then there was the odd news that Mr. Cohen had hired a Liberty University administrator to create a fake Twitter account saying that he, Mr. Cohen, was sexy, which was really weird. And then the President tweeted that an anonymous rancher had found Muslim prayer rugs in the New Mexico desert, and then the President tweeted that another caravan was coming, and all the while the government was shut down in large parts, and another winter storm is headed across the land, and here at church a pipe burst, and so the heat went out, and electric fuses have been blown downstairs because of the new construction, and they're knocking out walls. And then I read that one of my favorite poets, Mary Oliver, had died. And down on the mall yesterday, thousands of people marched in the Women's March. And in the middle of all of that, another news story came to light yesterday that I'm sure some of you saw. That awful video of a young man who evidently was in town to take part in, "Hey, sweetheart. Come here." "She is fine. Go sit down. How are you, Pumpkin? Are you good? You want to help me preach my sermon?"
"Yeah."
"It's kind of a sad sermon. Are you okay with that?" "Yeah, let's go then. And if you want to go back to your mom or dad, you let me know, okay?"
"Okay."
"You want to sit right there for a second? Because I'm going to need both hands. Are you good? Well, here. No. Here we go. So, I'm going to tell a sad story, all right? So this young man was in town for the March for Life, I guess, as near as we can tell, with his classmates. And at the same time, down on the mall, there was the Indigenous Peoples March taking place. And I'm not sure of the logistics that allowed those two things to sort of come together in a way. But as you saw in the news, I'm sure many of you saw, those two groups somehow converged on the steps near the Lincoln Memorial. They did, it happened. Two groups of people came together and they kind of had a little bit of a fight, I have to say. Not really, it was kind of a one-sided fight. If you saw the video, that young man, you gonna go back to your mom? You can stand right there, that's perfect. You can stand right there. You can stand right there. That does not bother me one bit. So these high school students met up with this man or these men who were taking part in the Indigenous People's March, and for whatever reason, they began this series of taunts and jeers, laughing in the face of this older man as he chanted and sang a prayer in his native tradition. One man in particular was the focus of the video, but there really were a group of high school students and their chaperones, it appears. And they treated this man as if he were a toy or a prop or someone or something to make fun of, as if he were somehow less than human. And I watched that video yesterday, I don't know, 10 times? You can come back up here. That's perfect. That's perfect. And I watched that video, and it was the kind of thing that just makes your heart either pound faster or stop. Just the grief involved in watching that. For me, part of that is personal. As you know, Amy and my children are members of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. My mother-in-law and her father and their ancestors are indigenous peoples. My wife and my children are indigenous peoples. And so to watch that high school student taunt and make fun of them was personally painful for me. And as I watched the picture of that young man, and I watched the expressions on his face, I also remembered that picture that I know many of you have seen from September the 4th, 1957, that picture in front of Central High School in Little Rock, where that young African-American woman, Elizabeth Eckford, is walking into school on the first day there. Hey, come here, pumpkin. It's fine. It is fine. Fine, fine. Go sit down. I will bring her back. She is so great, aren't you? Right? It is. You don't have to apologize. You know what? The reason we do this, the reason we stand here and think about sad things is because of this beautiful child. Because we see in her eyes and her laughter and her joking self hope and beauty, right? You can go wherever you want to. I do not care. That's a perfect place to sit during a sermon. Because Elizabeth Eckford, that student at Central High School, she once was that small. She once was that full of hope and life and possibility, just like all of us were. And as I saw the look on that boy's face as he taunted, I could see the look of those white students at Central High School taunting Elizabeth Eckford as well. And the third thing that made that even more poignant for me is that I remembered that just a few yards from the place where that young man was taunting that native elder is where Martin Luther King stood and made his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. And as I watched that video, I couldn't help but ask over and over again why that kind of thing happens. Because we all start out like this little one. That's why it's so great that she's running around here. Because we're all just like that at some point. And then we become these other creatures. We become creatures who no longer walk on the pews. Because we learn to sit still and be quiet, and sometimes we learn to hate. How do we live in this world where that happens? I've been reading physics lately, trying to understand the universe. In physics, there is a principle called the principle of complementarity. It is a principle, as I understand it, that comes from the field of quantum mechanics, quantum physics. Complementarity in physics says that to know a phenomenon, such as light, for instance, you have to measure it in two complementary ways. You have to measure light to understand it. You have to measure it both as a wave and as a particle, which seems easy enough. But the problem is, we don't know how to do that yet at the same time. We can't measure both light as a wave and light as a particle at the same moment. Because when we measure light as a particle, we disturb light as a wave, and when we measure light as a wave, we disturb it as a particle. The complementarity says that these different views, these different ways of measuring a subject are equally valid. And therein lies the complication of transferring this idea from physics to theology and sociology. I wrestle with that idea because, in part, I don't understand physics, but I wrestle with that idea as I think about how we understand people. How do we measure that which is good in people and that which may not be so good in people? How do we measure the sinfulness of a person and the divinity of a person? Complementarity seems to be the truth when I ponder my own life. I'm sometimes a good person, and sometimes I'm not. And I know many of you well enough to know that sometimes you're good people, and sometimes you're not. But somehow that's how we make a whole. That's a truth from physics. And I don't know what to do with that, because I don't really want it to be a truth in the universe. We watched this young man, I guess this took place on Friday. These young men, this entire group of classmates, carry out these despicable acts, this sinful sort of public spectacle. And then we watched as other people righteously responded by calling these teenagers awful names. And I get that. I have a friend, he's a minister in another denomination, and he's largely a peace-loving individual, and he tweeted that he'd just like to go punch that kid in the face. And I kind of get that. No, I don't kind of get that. I get that. I get that. Physics tells us that we can measure things in two ways, maybe not both at the same time. So physics, if we apply it to sociology and civility, says we have to measure that young man in one way, and that's where we're quick to lambast him and label him and call him names. And we also have to find another way to measure him, if you will, to find some spark of the holy in him. Just as he must learn to see that native man in another way. He must learn to see that indigenous person in front of him as a person, a fellow human full of gifts and graces. How do we learn to see each other wholly, and how do we learn to help each other see each other wholly? Martin Luther King said that darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Which says to me that calling that young man names and discounting him as less than human will not bring out the light in him. Nor will it bring out the love that I want to believe lives in him. Frank Wilczek, this physicist I have been reading lately, talks about this idea of complementarity in physics, about the difficulty of seeing and measuring light as both a wave and a particle. And he borrows an idea from an earlier physicist, Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr was the founder of quantum theory, and he understood something about these parallels in physics, these ideas that didn't seem to be reconcilable but operated alongside each other. And so Niels Bohr, a century ago, designed a coat of arms for himself as a way of understanding his view of physics. And in his coat of arms, this physicist, Niels Bohr, designed for his family crest, if you will, the ancient Chinese symbol of the yin and yang figure, a figure which is in more modern imagery portrayed on the cover of our bulletin. You know the yin and yang figure, these two parts of a circle that come together in a kind of overlapping, interweaving kind of ways. And Frank Wilczek, in thinking about complementarity and thinking about the contrasting elements of the natural world, chooses this yin and yang figure as an idea, as a symbol for that. And he says that these two elements, meaning the light and the dark of the yin and yang theory, he's also referring to them as the elements of matter and space-time, but these complementary ideas, he says, these two elements form an inseparable whole, and each contains and is contained in the other. The idea that these contrasting ideas, even conflicting ideas, they're a part of the human experience, form an inseparable whole and contain and are contained by each other. Two objects stand opposite to each other, completely opposite offering different realities. They're starkly different, and yet they hold each other in some way, even embrace each other in some way. I think we experience that when we understand ourselves as both human and divine. The problems are not always the problems of those out there in the world and those we see on the internet, but they are also problems that we bear in our own beings, if we are honest. The Apostle Paul wrote that he did the very things he did not want to do. He somehow recognized in his own self the image of God and the dreadful mistakes he was about. Mary Oliver, poet whom I greatly admired and who died earlier in the week, wrote about God in this way, and she said, "If God exists, he isn't just churches and mathematics. He's the forest. He's the desert. He's the ice caps that are dying. He's the ghetto and the museum of fine arts. He's the many desperate hands cleaning and preparing their weapons. He's every one of us, potentially, the leaf of grass, the genius, the politician, the poet. And if this is true, isn't it something very important?" The idea that God contains us all and we are all contained in God. I think Dr. King understood that when he said that we must all learn to live together as brothers. I would say as brothers and sisters or siblings. We must all learn to live together as siblings, or we will perish together as fools. It calls us to learn to relate to each other in new and different ways that I'm not sure I always want to do, to be honest. I'm not sure I'm brave enough, kind enough, good enough. Jesus said, you have heard it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, Jesus said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. You have heard that it was said to love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Dr. King preached a profound sermon on that verse, and he said to his congregation, I believe it was in Birmingham, he said to his congregation, certainly these are great words, words lifted to cosmic proportions. And over the centuries, many people have argued that this is an extremely difficult command, Dr. King went on. Many would go so far as to say that it just isn't possible. It just isn't possible to move out into the actual practice of this glorious command. They would go on to say that this is just additional proof that Jesus was an impractical idealist who never quite came down to earth. So the arguments abound, Dr. King said. But far from being an impractical idealist, Jesus has become the practical realist. The words of this text glitter in our eyes with a new urgency. Far from being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, this command is an absolute necessity for the survival of our civilization. Yes, it is love that will save our world and our civilization. Love even for our enemies, he said. And then he went on in the sermon to describe the reality of the world that he experienced as an African-American man in the 1950s and 1960s. The racism and the beatings and the systemic injustice and the legislation that prevented him from living as an equal citizen. And then he went on to say in that sermon, I think that Jesus says, love your enemies because of this. Love has within it a redemptive power. And there is a power that eventually transforms individuals. That's why Jesus says, love your enemies. Because if you hate your enemies, you have no way to redeem and to transform your enemies. But if you love your enemies, you will discover that at the very root of love is the power of redemption. As I watched that video yesterday of that young man taunting Nathan Phillips, this Omaha elder, this Native American, as I watched that young man taunting that Native American, after about the fourth or fifth or sixth time I watched it, I quit looking at the young man's smirk. I quit looking at his self-righteous smile, and I began to look at Nathan Phillips. I watched him as he steadily beat his drum and sang his song. And that young man laughed, and the crowd around him chanted, build the wall. And he sang, and he looked with purpose, with a sense of really being present in the world. I saw in his face, in his body language, a sense of resignation, perhaps, but not resignation that he was defeated, but resignation that he was alive, even if not everyone thought he should be. I saw in his face a determination and a grace. Dr. King went on in his sermon to say, you just keep loving people and keep loving them, even though they're mistreating you. Here's the person who is a neighbor, and this person is doing something wrong to you, and all of that. Just keep being friendly to that person. Keep loving them. That's the yin and the yang of it, that we live side by side with that with which we do not wish to live, but we do. That's the complication of love and hate being neighbors. He goes on to say, keep loving them. Don't do anything to embarrass them. Just keep loving them. And they can't stand it for too long. They may react in many ways in the beginning. They may react with bitterness because they're mad because you love them like that. They may react with guilt feelings, and sometimes they'll hate you a little more at that transition period, but just keep loving them. And by the power of your love, they will break down under the load. That's love, you see. It is redemptive. And this is why Jesus says, love. There is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. There is something about love that builds up and is creative. Love your enemies. Those are not easy words. It is not easy work. But that is our work, my friends. That is our work. To be love. To be light. That is our work. May it be so with us. Amen.